We are so lucky to have such a diversity of wildlife in our state, and really with every subtle change in the weather and season, you know, there are fascinating differences in what goes on with our wildlife. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Something to watch for and marvel at every season, isn't there? And no surprise, spring is really busy time in nature, and we're going to talk about that today with David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor in forest and wildlife ecology. And David, great to have you back with us.
Well, Larry, it's always a pleasant surprise to be invited back.
Well, it shouldn't be a surprise. Jamie Knack, you're not surprised, I hope. Jamie is a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. Great to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks, Larry.
We've got some great things we can talk about. By the way, you may have as you listen, you may have a question for my guests. Kinds of wildlife you've been noticing lately. Any particular concerns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You know, I think the spring is kind of a good time of the year to commence with this Keeping Wildlife Wild initiative that's going on. And Jamie, I know you're on that committee that looked at that.
Yeah, I'm one of the partners representing the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. But this is an exciting initiative that the Department of Natural Resources is taking the lead on. And it's called Keeping Wildlife Wild. And it's the main goal here is to help educate the general public who absolutely loves wildlife, as we do. But basically helping citizens understand how best they can help their wildlife neighbors. And really, we're talking about young animals and giving them some additional education about animal ecology and when to decide if an animal needs help or when it's best left alone because mother is nearby. So the initiative itself just recently kicked off, and the timing is perfect because we're in that early spring, summer season when lots of wildlife are having their young. And also, it's getting a little nicer outside, and people are out and about. So it's quite common for people to encounter young wildlife, whether that's a raccoon young in a yard, or maybe a baby bird that's on the ground, or a nest of rabbits. And sometimes people feel that they need to help those animals, or they think that they're in need of help. And so it's trying to decide how to address those situations. So in the case of baby bunnies, a lot of times folks don't realize that doe rabbit will only nurse them at dawn and dusk. And she essentially leaves the nest of rabbits in a lawn or a grassy area covered up and doesn't attend to them during the day. So if you stumble across that nest of bunnies, you might think that they've been abandoned because you don't see the adult rabbit nearby, when in fact, just knowing a little bit about their ecology, that's completely normal behavior, and you're best to just back away, observe from a distance, and keep dogs and children away from that nest as well.
Yeah, so that, and you know, Scott is, Craven has always said, well, this is about the time of year, like first of early May, when we go from the least amount of deer that we'll have in the course of a year to the most deer that we will have in the course of the year. So all those babies.
Yeah, and fawns are another really commonly reported animal where somebody, again, really well-intentioned, but they see a fawn come across one laying down or walking around, and they assume that mother, you know, they don't see the mother, so they assume that it's been abandoned or something happened to mom. So fawns are born with very little scent, and they have this classic white spots to help camouflage them to their surroundings. Their strategy is to lay still. Mother will lay them down somewhere. They'll bed down, and she'll go off and feed, and the fawn will be there for hours at a time before the mother comes back and nurses very quickly and then leaves again to go and find food for herself. So if you come across a fawn and it's curled up and it appears healthy and it's staying there, that's the strategy to avoid predators. It can't outrun a coyote or a dog or other prey at that young age. So it's doing what it should be doing.
And this is a great segue, I think, to a topic that we wanted to talk about relating to the UW-Madison, David. We've got a fox family living on the UW-Madison campus. When were they first spotted?
We have got a number of fox families living on the UW-Madison campus. We've been involved with a kind of a pilot project where we captured and radio collared two coyotes, and we captured and radio collared one male fox. And we were interested in trying to figure out kind of the interaction between coyotes and fox, and they're natural competitors. And if a coyote will come across a fox, it will, if it, given the chance, it will kill that fox. And so we're interested in that. And we're also interested in the interaction between those two canid or dog species and people. And you don't get much more urban than down in the middle of campus here. And we've got a fox family that has been denning under the Van Heist building here on campus. And that den flooded, and so they've since moved over to the Middleton building. And the mom or the vixen has been seen with eight kits at one time. And so yeah. we have tried to keep this secret because we didn't want people to bother the fox family, and we certainly don't want people to get bit or hurt if they approach the fox too closely. But the secret is no longer a secret, and there have been hundreds of people out looking at these animals, and to the point where we've now had to rope off the den site and things like that and put up signage. It's been a wonderful story because it's a great example of how well and how adaptable, you know, animals are. Some certain species of wildlife are to live in urbanized areas, and so that's kind of a fun thing to see, and so far the mom or the vixen does not seem to be bothered by all the people watching her and her kits, and she certainly has the opportunity to move those kits to a less visible den if she wanted to. And it's, I think, been wonderful for the people. You know, they don't expect to see a fox on campus, and now they're able to, and so it kind of reminds us that we're sharing this planet and this environment with a lot of other wonderful wildlife species.
How long will those kits stay with mom?
About 7 months. So we think they were born in the beginning of March because we saw them. They'll pop up above the den maybe when they're about 4 or 5 weeks old, something like that. And we saw them for the first time March 31st. So we think the beginning of March, and they'll stick with her probably until the end of summer, maybe September, and then they'll get pushed out.
Well, it's really a lot of fun. And I know Judith's already got some posts up on our Facebook page. At the Larry Mueller Show, there's a story, at least a story, and some photos as well, if I'm not mistaken. So,
yep, and there's a great video attached to that that news link that Judith has up on the page. But if you come to campus or if you're on campus here, walk by the Middleton building, and maybe you'll be lucky enough to see the mom and her eight kits. And unfortunately, the male who was the male partner of that family is the one that we had radio collared, and he just got killed by a car in University Avenue Friday night, about 4 miles west of the den site. So it's unfortunate, but not terribly unexpected, and that's what we're guessing is the primary cause of mortality for these animals in these urban environments is automobiles, and certainly that was the case for the dad.
Don in Warren, Illinois, has a comment for you guys. Don, hi, thank you for calling.
We burned a postage stamp prairie we have here on the edge of Warren, little bitty town.
Yeah.
When we got done, we found four very large eggs. They're tan with brown spots on them. They're 42 millimeters long. The nest was ruined. I thought I knew flora and fauna, but boy, was I dumb. It has to be a woodcock. What can you tell me about it? I haven't seen one in more than 65 years.
Yeah. Well, hi, Don. Thanks for the call. And the size, how would you compare it to the size of a chicken egg?
Do you know your metric system well enough to say 42 millimeters long? More than an inch and a half. So it was like a pullet egg.
Yeah.
Woodcock are going to typically nest in a forest understory in the leaf litter. My best guess in terms of what that critter is that it was probably a turkey. And with four eggs, they typically have a larger clutch size than that. So she was probably still laying eggs. She hadn't started to incubate yet. And as far as being concerned about, destroying that nest, she will likely re-nest because it was destroyed so early in the season. So, you know, unfortunately with controlled burns, that, you know, certainly happens. We do lose some wildlife, but the gain in terms of the habitat quality that returns after the prairie, it's probably a cost-benefit wise, it's a benefit to be doing these prairie burns. So I think most likely that was a turkey nest and just initiated, so she will most likely re-nest.
And turkeys are an interesting bird, so she will not have to get rebred by the male in order to re-nest, so she can keep the sperm viable in her reproductive tract, I think, for 30 or so days. And so as long as she has been rebred or bred within the last 30 days, she'll just go and lay another nest, as Jamie said, and we'll get on with life.
It does seem like a small egg, though, for a turkey egg, doesn't it? Or is that about...
Yeah, it might be a little small. I mean, we've got some grassland nesting birds that are coming back up now, but... Yeah.
Turkey, though. Huh?
Yeah, pheasant's another possibility, although they have a tough time surviving the winter. But, you know, a pheasant's a possibility, but more likely a game bird.
A turkey.
Yeah.
Not a songbird with it being that large. Yeah.
Turkey would certainly be the first guess, yeah. Okay. I would think.
There you go, Don. Thank you. Appreciate the call. Romy in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hey, hi. I was just wondering if any of you heard about the squirrel's nest. Now, my grandpa always used to tell me, you can tell how bad of a winter we're going to have by looking at the squirrel's nest. Now, this year was the first year I saw every single squirrel nest at the top of the tree. I mean, it wasn't random where one was in the middle and maybe 3/4 of the way up. I mean, every single squirrel, every county I went to, they, like, took the last branch at the tip of the top of the tree. And I told everybody, yep, we're going to have a bad
winter coming, huh? Well, what do you think about that, David?
So, Romy, just so I understand your question, so the assumption is that the higher up the nest is in the tree, the worse the winter is going to be.
Exactly.
Okay.
My grandpa told me that for sure.
Yeah, I think I don't want to question your grandfather because he sounds like a wonderful man, but I'm not sure that there's any correlation between the height of the nest in the tree, or squirrels' nests are called drays. Sometimes you'll hear them referred to as drays. I'm not sure there's any correlation between the height of that dray and the severity of the winter. And you know, hopefully, I like to think that if the nest is way high up in the tree, we're not getting that much snow that they need to be that high up in the tree. But, you know, so I think that there's a lot of kind of those old wives' tales or folklore, you know, about it. The other thing is the woolly caterpillar. The mm-hmm. thicker the bands are on the caterpillar, the worse the winter is going to be and things like that. So there's a lot of that stuff that's captured in the Farmer's Almanac that I'm not sure if it's ever been demonstrated to be factually true. But it is an interesting supposition.
I'm thinking about the squirrels' nests that are around our house,
yeah.
And they're all pretty high.
They're pretty high up, that's right.
They're way up there, so maybe Romy's got something going.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, squirrels' nests typically are more spherical, but you do have crow's nests that are roughly the same size, and you can get some raptor's nests, like hawk's nests, that especially if the nest is just beginning, can be the same size. And those nests are typically spherical on the bottom, but they'll be flat on top. And so sometimes there can be confusion between those nests. And, you know, crows and some of the raptors are also nesting up pretty high up in the tree, too. So it possibly could be another type of nest beside the squirrel. But I will keep my eye on that. And that's a pretty neat thing that your grandfather told you.
Yeah. And then I came up to say, well, maybe there's some kind of jet stream up there that stops all the wind there at a certain level. Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my hypothesis. But anyway, I'll let you guys go, and I'll keep on listening.
All right. Thanks,
Romy.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, my favorite observation of squirrels in a squirrel nest, I was out in the woods in the early fall in September, and this had to be a late family, but I was observing a tree with a squirrel's nest, and there was a shaking of that nest. And here comes the mom out with a baby wrapped around its neck. And she goes down the tree and she goes over about 30 feet to another tree, climbs up, puts the squirrel in the new nest.
Yeah.
She relocated
And then
them.
She relocated every single one. And I'm looking at the tree and I'm the two trees and I'm looking at. Why?
Well, why the move?
Because the nests look the same. The trees look pretty similar.
They've got multiple drays. So, you know, squirrel have multiple drays that she'll, and it's pretty common for them to move, and nobody's quite sure why. But one of the thoughts is that some of these nests get infected or infested with mites and ectoparasites.
Oh.
And so it's an opportunity to get into a clean nest that's not infested with an ectoparasite.
Oh, that is a good explanation. I had not thought of that at all. I was at a loss to figure out why the heck she just moved over a couple of trees.
It's Tuesday. It's time to move.
Oh, man. Well, we got Brian online. You can join in, too, if you have a question or comment. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234 with your wildlife question or observation. You want to give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page. And if you have, let's go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And if you've got a photo, wildlife photo, we always love to see those as well. Brian in Menominee up next with a question. Hi, Brian.
Hello. Hello. I live right in the city limits, and we have a beautiful yard. I've planted many trees and things, and we try to attract wildlife, and mainly birds, obviously. We have feeders. We have birdhouses. Problem we're having is during the evening, everybody lets their cats run. And they're already killing off the birds that have come from the spring because we find the feathers and pieces of the birds around the feeders. So I am thinking this year, you know, I've kind of had enough of it, you know, because, you know, the birds will nest, and every time we have little baby birds, they disappear at night. So I'm thinking of getting a live trap this year and trapping them. And I was just wondering if you had any comments on that.
Well, thanks for the call, Brian. And I just want to preface this by saying that this is a hugely sensitive issue, as I'm sure you are well aware. Folks who do own cats, and I just lost my cat this last fall. She was an indoor cat. I'll qualify with that. But folks that own cats and do allow them to be outdoors feel very strongly about that opportunity for their cats. I've kind of changed my way of trying to talk with people about keeping cats outside when I have educational programs that I'm involved with, and try to turn it in terms of, you know, what are the negative things that can happen to the cat, so that if you love your cat, mm-hmm. you would not allow it to be outside, because one, it can get run over by a car. It can get eaten by a predator like a coyote or a fox, which are mm-hmm. certainly very good at inhabiting urban areas. There are the disease risks with encountering wildlife. So one suggestion, Brian, is, and I know this takes some bit of effort, is to maybe start talking with neighbors and seeing if you can't get a little bit of education out to them. The Cats Indoor campaign, which is done through the American Bird Conservancy, so Cats Indoors, is an excellent website that takes it in that angle. It talks about the safety of the cat. Why should you keep the cat indoors? So it's kind of looking at things from a different approach. However, to answer your question specifically, cats are not protected. So you legally could trap those cats and decide what to do with them after that. Just because there isn't a collar doesn't mean that they're feral.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you could work, you could take them to the Humane Society. That's certainly an option. But again, just knowing how sensitive this issue is, it might be something that's worth some communication between some of your neighbors and start tackling it from an education standpoint and seeing if you can't work together by understanding the whole situation.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm thinking, you know, there are certain kinds of birdhouses that I know somebody has characterized one bluebird house type as an owl feeder.
Yeah.
There are other as well. There could be other animals.
But there's a lot in the scientific literature now as far as cats go. There is a lot of scientific evidence in terms of the millions of animals. And it's not just birds. It's small mammals, and it's reptiles and amphibians. And even though you might use a really safe birdhouse, they still visit feeders, and the feeder placement, you know, can serve as an ambush. If there's shrubs around the feeders, it can be an ambush point for cats as well. So, you know, I know there's a lot, you know, folks, if the cat wears a bell or it's declawed, folks feel that they're not going to attack a wildlife, and it's just, they just have such an intense prey drive that they're very adept predators.
Yeah, and it's amazing. I know stories about cats with bells, even multiple bells, that are still able to keep those bells quiet.
Yeah.
And go out and kill them.
But it is hugely sensitive, so...
We have two cats, and they are never outside. Well, and except to go to the vet.
Yep.
Or if you want to let them be outside, put them on a leash and try to monitor them as they're outside the best you can.
They really, outdoor cats have about, what is it, half the life expectancy of indoor cats.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many different things that can happen to them from being outside. Just the disease risk and the injury risk alone.
Yep. So there you go, Brian. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. My guests today, David Drake and Jamie Nack of the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We had an email from Monica and Marinette who said, I'd really like to have some help. We must demolish our garage this summer, and for decades, she says, the flycatchers have delighted us by building their nest under the eave on the north side of the garage. They return this spring, and they're, what I think, an old nest still under the eaves. What are the nesting habits of flycatchers? Should we remove the nest at this date, or is it too late already? What should we do?
Well, we've got a number of what's called flycatchers in the state of Wisconsin. They're all migratory birds. Flycatchers, as the name implies, they're insectivores, so they capture insects, you know, flying insects. And examples of flycatchers would be phoebes or willow flycatchers, things like that, eastern kingbirds. I'm guessing, however, flycatchers will nest primarily in trees, and I'm guessing that she might mean instead a barn swallow. And barn swallows are the birds that are also insectivores. They're also migratory birds. They're the ones who build that mud nest up underneath eaves and kind of a append it to your side of your house. So I think it's barn swallows that you're thinking about. And as long as there are no eggs in that nest, you are able and legal to destroy the nest. But once an egg is deposited in that nest is protected unless you have a permit to destroy the egg in the nest. You must let that nest run the life of its course, or the course of its life, either where the birds fledge or the nest gets destroyed. And at that point, then you can destroy the nest again and then destroy the barn. But unless you have a permit from the federal government, because these are migratory birds, that if there's an egg in that nest, you have to let that nest be until the nest is completed.
And you have to be pretty persistent. I had every year on my boat hoist, I had them coming, barn swallows coming in, and I would be out there every single day to get the nest down, or, you know, a piece of the nest, and they were right back in there.
Yep.
And so sometimes more than once a day.
Well,
yeah.
And to add to, I think Monica was looking maybe a little bit at timing, but whether this is a robin, a phoebe, swallows, the process for their nest, they're going to lay eggs and incubate 10 to 14 days, and then it's going to take another 10 to 14 days for the adult to go ahead and fledge that nest. So depending on when you're looking to take that barn down, if they've started that nest and the eggs are already there, you legally can't remove them. However, even if she just built the nest and hasn't started laying eggs, it's going to take roughly a month for her to fledge that nest. So if that's within the window, if it finishes in end of May, then go ahead and, you know, let that continue. If you want to stop that process, if she hasn't laid eggs, then you're going to need to continue to remove nests up until the time that you want to demolish the building. And in place of when you remove those nests, you can put things like bird guards or some spike strips or some aluminum foil or pie plates to discourage them from nesting in that area. So, but you have roughly a month for a nest to fledge the young, and then you can work on the building.
Hmm. Gary and Rhinelander, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Hey, here for the last couple of months, we've been having a fox that's been coming into our yard. And I'm an avid photographer, and I've been trying to get pictures of him. And I see him trying to chase one of the wild bunny rabbits. Is there some sort of a food that I could put in an area to maybe make a better photo opportunity for me, or any ideas?
Well, Gary, what we were talking about on campus here, we have red foxes, but we also have gray foxes in the state of Wisconsin. And a red fox is more of an open land, grassy pasture type species, uses some woodlands. But the gray fox is sometimes referred to as the tree fox because it's a forested species. And so, and up in Rhinelander, you're up in the North Woods, and it is possible you may have a gray fox up there. Is that what you're looking at? Do you know, is it a gray fox or a red fox?
Well, I haven't had a great look at them, but yesterday I mean, he's very large.
Okay.
So I would think it was a gray fox larger than the rest?
They're about the same size, roughly. And, you know, a good size male adult fox is maybe 15 pounds, so maybe the size of a hefty house cat, something like that, a little bit taller in terms of the height of the leg. But in terms of getting a good photo opportunity, you know, animals are very much creatures of habit, and I'm guessing that animal is running through your yard at roughly the same time and probably the same spots or general spots. And so maybe if you can, the easier thing, and it's difficult, this is not like feeding a bird, for example, where you can put up a bird feeder and the birds are going to come to it. It would be difficult to feed this fox, and you don't want to do that anyway. But the better thing to do is maybe see if you can study its habits and determine if it's on some bit of a time schedule where it's in your yard at roughly the same time and in the same general area of your yard at that time, and then get your camera set either from inside the house, or maybe you want to put a blind up in your yard and for a better viewing opportunity from the blind, for example. So that would be my suggestion to you.
Yeah,
and Gary, that fox is going to be most active early morning and again at dusk. So your time windows right now, 6-7 o'clock in the morning would be a really good time to kind of be out there. You'll have better, better opportunities narrowing in on the time than being out there in the middle of the day. And just in terms of feeding wildlife, it just usually doesn't end up a good situation for the animals. That's not the correct food source for them, and they become habituated to people and ultimate can end up in a bad problem. Outcome for the animal.
Yeah,
so.
There you go. Thanks, Gary. Valerie and Boaz, hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. Hi, this is another photography-related question. I put out a trail camera in the woods, and in the winter, somebody ate it. And the photos are really funny, and we've kind of concluded that it was a squirrel. And I'm wondering if that was a territorial thing or how I can keep it from happening again.
Well, Valerie, squirrels are members of the rodent family. And I know from folks that have run plastic tubing for maple syrup lines, or just in terms of mice in the garage with wiring and in the homes, that they like to gnaw and chew, and they need to keep grinding down their incisors. Porcupines will chew on things that people have even touched, like a handle on an axe, because there's salt within the perspiration of our hands, and they can sense that salt. So there's lots of reasons why they might be chewing on it. Some just
like $140 camera.
I know. I understand. I know that for larger animals, particularly in the north where there are black bears, many camera companies will make a cage that you can put the camera in, and it's really a deterrent from black bears. And that might also work well, or you can look at different models, and that might work really well for you for squirrels. There's also the potential to use like a Miller's hot sauce that has some capsaicin in it, like some hot pepper powder that you could put on the camera that would deter them as a taste repellent. But as far as, you need to reapply something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But thank you.
Valerie, I'm guessing they probably are chewing on the corners of your camera. Is that right?
You know what? I think it was a squirrel, got it open, gnawed right through the plastic cover so that the computer chip was exposed, and then it ate like all the foam padding that was inside the camera. Yeah. Do you think he was hungry too? I mean, it was such a tough winter, or it's just strictly the gnawing to keep
The gnawing to keep their teeth down. But the reason I asked, a lot of times they'll gnaw on the corners, and sometimes you can just put strips of thin sheet metal that you can form around the corners, and that would be enough to protect the camera from a squirrel, not from a bear. From a bear, you're going to need something a little bit heftier than that. But that's maybe something to think about in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Val, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lorianne is a Canadian truck driver who listens to our show all the time when she's passing through the state. She wonders if the air horns to scare deer away from the roadways, do those really work, the air horns? And if not, is there anything she can do?
Well, Lorianne, the reason I was laughing, this is a funny story that dates back to Scott Craven's time. And Scott got into a bit of a tussle, I guess, with Schneider Trucking, which is, I think, the largest trucking company in the country based out of Green Bay, Wisconsin. And they had just bought a bunch of these. And I'm guessing what you're talking about, the little air
deer whistles
that you put on your bumper. Schneider had just bought a bunch of them for their entire national fleet. And Scott had just, prior to that, unknowing that Schneider had bought all these, came out with this this statement correctly that these do not work. And yeah. Schneider, I guess, called the provost office, and poor Scott got called to the provost office and all that. But typically they do not work. And if you think about the amount of noise on it, especially a semi-truck or an automobile, you know, the road noise from the tires, from the wind blowing past the car, past the antennas, things like that, there is plenty of noise coming off of that vehicle already that the deer can hear. They know the vehicle is there, that whistle is not going to do any more to alert the deer than what is already present with the noise coming off that vehicle. So no, they do not work. Do not waste your money on them, but it is a good thought. And unfortunately, they don't work. It would be great if we had something, a silver bullet like that, to reduce the deer vehicle collisions in this country.
That'd be wonderful.
It sure would.
Lynn in Evansville. Hi, thank you for calling.
And thank you all for taking my call. My questions have to do with birds, obviously. And I have a backyard set of feeders that are immediately adjacent to a mulberry tree and then surrounded by some tall maples.
Yep.
And I feed a number of songbirds. My problem stems from the fact that last year in the surrounding area, there was a family of red-tailed hawks who found my neighborhood very fertile for prey. And that includes birds at my feeder. And they've returned this year. I've seen them now a couple of occasions attacking my birds. And I'm wondering, is there something I can do, like if I were to erect a pergola over the feeders, would that trap the songbirds, or would that deter the hawks, or to give them any additional protection? Is there anything you might suggest?
So, Lynn, it's a very common question that we get. And I guess when you think about the diets of these animals, I mean, hawks, that's one of their key prey species, sharpshins, Cooper's hawks. They're going to feed on small songbirds. And a really good place for them to look for these birds is at bird feeders. So, a lot of times birders are okay with that whole idea that raptors are going to
eat. Part of nature.
Yeah, that it's part of nature, exactly.
It's not in my backyard.
And they're happy to have and be able to see a Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned or a red-tail, which a red-tail typically is going to take small mammals and potentially small rabbits, maybe a squirrel, a young squirrel.
It might have been a Cooper. I'm sorry.
Yeah, usually it's the accipiters that have a little bit more maneuverability.
Yep.
So most, you know, I don't want to say most, but a lot of birders are just content to be able to see that Cooper's hawk and think that's a pretty neat observation. But if that doesn't sit well with you, and you might not really like this idea either, but if you remove your bird feeders or take them in for a week or so, then that hawk will go somewhere else to look for small birds to prey on. And after it's left, then you can go ahead and put it back up.
Oh, really?
And it may return again.
Uh-huh.
But that is one strategy, is to remove the feeder itself. And then the other thing is, if there's a, and again, you're kind of removing habitat in this sense, but if there's a favorite perch, you could remove some of these perches that the hawks are finding to sit on, because they do need a vantage point to be able to hunt from. And again, I would probably encourage you not to do that, because you know, they serve other sources too, like the red-tailed hawks and owls are going to help keep the rabbit population down.
Their modus operandi seems to be coming from high to low, so they swoop down, and it's from these tall maples, which I can't get rid of.
So I think really, I mean, just moving your feeder location is a possibility. You could move it closer to a window.
They're planted in the ground pretty deeply. So if I just stopped feeding, if I emptied them, and there are other feeders in the neighborhood, just stop feeding all birds for a
time? Just wouldn't be occurring in your backyard, but it is still likely going to be occurring
somewhere else.
But,
yep.
Hey, as a friend of ours says, Jason Succo is a good friend of ours, and he always says, well, it is a bird feeder after all.
And I was just showing David a picture, a photo that I took with my phone, which is about 10 feet from my office building on campus, and that hawk is eating a rabbit.
Yep. A red-tailed hawk, which we've got. Red-tailed hawks, we've got, we have certainly Coopers and and sharp-shinned hawks here. We've got peregrine falcons on campus, and we've got we've had bald eagles flying overhead. So we've got our share. We've got owls on campus. We've got a pretty good diversity of raptors on campus here as well.
Yeah. I should post. I'll post that on my Facebook page because it's a nice shot. Students were stopping, and I was literally 5 feet away from the bird, and the bird is just. Kept eating.
Yep.
There you go, Lynn. Thank you for calling, by the way. And we're going to get to Mike in Iron River, Michigan in just a minute. But just to remind you, our guest today, David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension, and Jamie Deck, wildlife outreach specialist. They're both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in as we take a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW-Madison Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Great to have them along. You have a question or comment, I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. If you've got a photo, I hope you'll post it on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and you can post it there. I'm going to try to post this a photo of my red tail in a minute or two here when I have a chance. But let's go to Mike now in Iron River, who's been waiting a bit. Mike, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Thank you. Yes, I'm driving down the road from Rhinelander going back to Iron River, and I heard your call about squirrels building high nests or whatnot. Well, there's another indication is when bees build nests high up in the air or close to the ground that supposed to indicate the amount of snow we're getting for the coming winter. I've seen them up 30 feet up in the air though, but I don't know. I think that's kind of a wives' tale, but I don't know.
Mike, I think I would agree with you that that's a wives' tale. And, you know, with bees, we're not the entomologists on campus here. Is Phil still on even though he quit his day job?
Yeah, he's still on.
So when Phil Pelletieri comes back onto the radio with Larry, uh-huh. Mike, call back with that. But, you know, we do have bees that their life history or ecology is to nest in the ground. We've got our other bee species, and their ecology or life history is to nest up in trees and in people's attics and things like that. So, I think it is a wives' tale, and it probably has more to do with the species of bee and where they're nesting relative to the winter. I don't believe there's any correlation with that any more than there is with squirrels' nests. But when Phil comes on, call back in.
All right. Thank you for calling. Tom and Leona, hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my question today. It's related to deer feeding, and I noticed the last couple of years I've been living in the North Woods, a number of people feed with corn, and then as the season progresses and pumpkins and apples come ripe, they feed with them. And instead of that, I started using mineral blocks, these complete mineral blocks that you'd use for horses or cattle. And I wonder, since it's still legal to feed here, what do you think's the most advisable feed?
Well, Tom, even though you just mentioned it, I do want to be perfectly clear that there are a number of counties throughout the state, probably approaching half, where feeding deer is illegal, and that's because of the threat of chronic wasting disease, both in those counties, but really statewide. But there are still counties, as you mentioned, where feeding and baiting is still legal. There are certainly some regulations along how much feed and how much bait can be placed. And there's been a lot of concerns this winter over the long, cold, lots of snow winter that we've been having in northern Wisconsin. And there's been a lot of public that's been interested in trying to supplementally feed the deer herd to help it through the winter. And again, really good intentions, but unfortunately, what they're feeding, whether it's straight corn or straight hay, is really deadly to these animals. They are not, their body has not habituated to an all corn diet or an all hay diet at this time of the year. They're typically eating buds and browsing. So it can be detrimental from the health side. Typically from a wildlife scientific community, we don't advocate feeding wildlife or providing supplements because it concentrates animals and it can be a reservoir to spread diseases. So, you know, what we try to promote or encourage is long-term habitat management, planting native trees and shrubs, putting in a shelter belt, having bedding areas, whether that's grasses or evergreens, winter cover, thermal cover, providing more of that their habitat needs, but in a more natural sense. So to answer your question, though, if you still would like to look down those lines, Whitetails Unlimited, Quality Deer Management Association would probably be good avenues for you. They'd have a lot of information in terms of food plots and what types of food plots and what to plant. But again, you know, we kind of support more of a natural food habitat management. So another big thing is harvesting timber, regenerating the forest. So somebody who's owned land for the last 40 years and is starting to see a decline in the deer on their property, it might be more of a situation where that is an aging of the forest and they haven't been doing any timber stand improvement or selective harvesting to regenerate that forest. So the deer have moved on because the forest is over mature for that particular species.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Then as a follow-up question, it sounds like you'd advocate stopping feeding altogether then statewide. Is that correct?
From a science standpoint, from the disease standpoint, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Yeah, people like to, you know, and I can see, you know, I've...
Everybody enjoys watching wildlife. You know, I'm bringing them in close and observing.
Caring for the welfare of them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Have really good intentions. It's the whole initiative with the Keeping Wildlife Wild. I mean, it's because we all love wildlife. Yep. We enjoy seeing them and we're, you know...
Yep.
Glad to have such a rich diversity of wildlife in the state, but you know we need to know what to do to keep it that way.
For sure.
Marge in Green Bay, hello. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my phone call. I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about juncos. Up until about the first of this week, I still had juncos at my backyard feeders, and to me it sounded like it was awfully late for them to be in town. I thought maybe they would have gone north already.
Marge, we still have juncos down here in the southern part of the state, in Dane County,
well. So
and
they haven't migrated yet.
Nope, they sure haven't. They're starting to move a little bit, but they're starting to thin out a little bit down here. But obviously, with juncos, they're one of the bird species that instead of going south or migrating south, those species actually migrate into our area. They come from further north into our area during the winter, and then they go further back up to the north in the spring. So they'll be moving here pretty soon. But they're still around here, so I think it's probably about average time for them.
Good, because I enjoy, they are so cute to watch.
They are, yep, and they're one of those easily recognizable birds with, you know, very, very dark colored on top and very light or white colored on the bottom. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. You tell that person that's got hawks in their backyard to take and get the crows to come live in their neighborhood, and the crows will take and harass the hawks, and the hawks will leave.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Crows are very good mobbers of hawks because hawks will predate or eat crows if they get a chance. But that's a double-edged sword because you also don't want an urban crow roost in your neighborhood because that can be very loud and very very messy and very smelly if it gets to be too big of a problem. And that's a worse problem sometimes than having a hawk here and there.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks, Marge, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Phil in McHenry, Illinois, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, you guys. I have kind of a question, comment, and see if you can explain to me the activity. This winter when we hit our happy 25 below on a lot of mornings at, let's say 0 to 10 below, I found some bald eagles in northern Illinois that were working a creek that never froze over because it was relatively rapid moving. Mature eagle with a white head, two younger eagles, one turning, one not turning. When I was 100, 150 yards away on a small bridge photographing them, they wanted nothing to do with me, and they flew off, so I quit doing that. I only did that once. I thought, I don't want to bother the eagles. Found out there was a side road through a farm, talked to a farmer and said, is it okay if I drive slowly up that road? Yeah, don't get stuck. The snow's 4 feet deep. Drove up the road very slowly and photographed the eagles from my SUV through the window without ever leaving. I got within 20 yards. The birds had no problem with that. Could they not discern I was in the car, or do they not see the car as any kind of threat or anything bothering them?
Yeah, I think, Phil, that it was more the ladders. That they probably could not see you as easily through the windshield, and who knows how the sun was glinting off the windows and the windshield, and perhaps they couldn't see. They may have seen your form, but they don't see the definition of your body as easily as when you're out of the car. And so, and they're probably more used to, you know, vehicles coming and going. They see probably a lot more cars than they see people. And it also might have been an issue if they were at that creek because, as you indicated, it was open and they were there feeding and they had a purpose and they wanted to get some food, and maybe they were annoyed at you being there because you were kind of hampering their feeding opportunity.
There we go. And thanks a lot for calling. We have an email from John in Kimberly, who says, we have a gray fox visit several times a week. He loves to eat the peanuts we put out for the squirrels. So that kind of surprised me that fox would eat peanuts, but maybe that's not such a surprise.
Oh, they're probably opportunistic. You know, they're probably, you know, mostly considered a carnivore, but they eat a lot of fruits and berries and stuff like that, too. So certainly at this time of the year, anything palatable is probably, you know, something they're going to go for. It's been a long, rough winter for a lot of wildlife.
It sure has. Yeah. And people.
Yeah, not their typical item, but, you know, not surprising that they'd opportunistically eat it. So.
And Michael in Bear Valley, hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, we've got a feeder outside of our kitchen window here, and well, one interesting bird we had this year that I hadn't seen before is a myrtle warbler. And the other question I had was about shrikes. It actually happened so quickly that I didn't get a good chance to identify it, but a bird swept down at our feeder grabbed a bird, I guess. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about shrikes.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. So we have two species of shrikes that occupy our state. One is the northern shrike, which is here more or less year-round, and then we have the loggerhead shrike also. And the loggerhead shrike seems to leave our state in the winter or is not here as persistently through the winter as the northern shrike is. And shrikes are really interesting birds. So both of those species have, if you look at the top bill, it's kind of a hooked bill like a raptor's is, and they've got kind of a black face mask, and they're maybe the size of a thin mourning dove, something like that. And shrikes will eat, they will eat small rodents like, you know, small young mice and things like that, but they are very common to eat grasshoppers. And one thing that's really, really interesting about shrikes is they will impale their food either on barbed wire or on thorns of like buckthorn and some of the thornier vegetation. And then they'll impale their food on there, and then they'll come back and eat it. So it's a way for them to cache the food or store the food. And really, really interesting birds. Shrikes are not a terribly large bird, and for taking, for example, a chickadee from your feeder, that would be a little unusual for a shrike to do that. And I'm wondering if maybe, again, if we go back to the Cooper's hawk or the sharp-shinned hawk that we were talking about, that if sharp shins are smaller than Cooper's, and so I'm guessing probably it may have been a sharp shin hawk you were looking at. But shrikes are very distinctive looking birds, and you would not, if you look them up in a bird book, you would not confuse a shrike with a sharp shin hawk. So if you get a chance to see the bird again, maybe take a look at either, you know, Google the image or look in the bird book and get that image in your mind, so the next time you see it, you can make a positive identification.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Karen in Webster, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Your guest speaker addressed a question from a lady who said that she had phoebes nesting in her barn, she was going to take down the barn, et cetera. And your guest noted that phoebes generally nest in trees, and so therefore she was probably referring to barn swallows or something of the sort. And I just wanted to let you know that we have phoebes that build nests every year under the eaves of our house above doors. And so they do not always, you know, live in
live out in the trees, nest in the trees.
Yeah, Karen, this is David, and I'm the one who made that comment. And you're absolutely right about phoebes. I'm sorry if I was confusing on that. What I was talking about was flycatchers in general. And so if you think about like Acadian flycatchers and willow flycatchers and kingbirds and things like that, those are the ones, the flycatcher species that nest in trees. Phoebes, you are absolutely right. Phoebes will nest sometimes in eaves. They're more common sometimes to nest under culverts, those big pipes that go under bridges and under roadways. And a lot of times at the top of the culvert, you'll find phoebe nests there. So you are right. Of the flycatcher species, phoebes would be more likely to nest in the eaves. But again, the more common bird that nests in eaves is the barn swallow.
Yeah, there we go.
But you're absolutely right, Karen. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, we've had quite a few calls from the northern part of the state, and I just wanted to put out a little note here. If you are in the northern part of the state, I hope you'll come out for a meet and greet with me in Washburn, Wisconsin. I love that little city. It's Thursday, May 15th, from 6 to 7:30. We're going to raise a toast to the arrival of spring, and we'll enjoy some food from Coco's. And you'll have a chance to win some prizes. I think we even have tickets to the Big Top Chautauqua, among other things. So we need to know how many people are coming. And so for that, you need to call. Give us a call at 608-263-9525. 608-263-9525. Once more, it's 608-263-9525. We have a link up on my Facebook page as well. And that's coming up on Thursday, May 15th. And I would really love to see you there. It's actually the day after my birthday, as a matter of fact. So we'll probably we'll have a little toast. Yeah, raise a glass of beer to that as well. So anyway, that's May 15th in Washburn. That's a Thursday from 6 to 7:30. We'll be with David and Jamie right up until 12:30 today. You stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. We're taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our two guests, Jamie Knack, a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW. And Jamie, great to see you.
Hey, thanks. Great to be here.
David Drake, wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. David, thank you as well.
Thank you, Larry.
We have callers online, but if you have a question, a wildlife question, I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And certainly, if you have some photos, we'd love to see those as well up on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Greg and Stoddard, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Actually, my question is about something I saw in Grant County rather than Stoddard. But on Easter Sunday, we're sitting around outside. It was so beautiful. And there was a bird singing in the top of the trees in the yard at my brother-in-law's farm. And we were all wondering, what is that song? It was very distinct, but don't ask me to repeat it. The bird was yellow, like almost canary yellow, but not quite that bright. It was probably the size of a dove to a blue jay. It had a rounded head. It had a long, black, pointed beak, as in long, maybe an inch or inch and a quarter, I don't know. It had a black collar underneath of its bill. And otherwise, it was, I don't know, had a long tail. And it was, when I looked in my Audubon book, because I teased my sister-in-law because she didn't have one, and because we were all wondering what it was. And when I looked in my Audubon book that night, we couldn't find it in there either. And it looks sort of like a mockingbird, only with that yellow color. Any ideas?
Greg, could you sing the song for us? Greg, I'm guessing it's probably a meadowlark. And meadowlarks are a bird that are associated with grassland areas, habitats. And I was going to ask you the type of habitat you saw it in, but when you mentioned that it was on a farm, meadowlarks are very common species on farms because of all the hay fields and open habitat there. And their song,
beautiful song.
It's a beautiful song. And the way people kind of describe the song in human terms is spring of the year, Spring of the Year, and it's a pretty distinct song once you start listening to it. So maybe go back in your bird book with your sister or your sister-in-law and take a look at meadowlark. And we have eastern and western meadowlarks in Wisconsin here, and you're down, obviously, Grant County's in the southwestern part of the state, so it is possible you could have a western meadowlark there. And what differentiates the two species is how much yellow is up into the cheek of the face, for the most part, and a little bit of the song. But take a look at meadowlark, and I'm wondering if that's not the bird you saw.
Okay, I'll do that. It did have, I don't know if I said it, it had a mottled background back on it that was kind of like that kind of a bird.
So take a look and see, down in Grand County, unfortunately, there's bad news down there with the white nose syndrome, so that was just found in the state of Wisconsin down there as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I tell you that it's rare that I hear that song anymore, meadowlark.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just not. I mean, that was of my youth. That was a favorite song to hear.
Yep.
My master's research was on grassland birds, and they're as a habitat guild of a group of animals that represent similar habitat. They've declined more rapidly than any other guild over the last four decades.
But so. it's a good indicator that spring is here, too, when you start hearing that song.
Yep.
Absolutely. And, you know, you did mention the bats and the white nose syndrome. We do have it now in Wisconsin identified.
Yeah, unfortunately. So white nose syndrome is a fungal disease that's been attacking bats, cave hibernating bats, so bats that hibernate during the winter, primarily in caves and mines. It was first found in 2006 out of upstate New York near Albany. And the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has done a phenomenal job of being very proactive and trying to stave it off from being here in Wisconsin. But it was not unexpected that it finally showed up here. And we almost got out of this winter. So once the bats get out of the cave for the winter, they're safe for another year until they go back into hibernation for the next winter. And they found it in a cave in Grant County in the southwesternmost county in the state of Wisconsin, I think March 28th, that last week in March. And unfortunately, 11 bats were found to have it, and so it is here in the state of Wisconsin. In somewhat of a good news, it's isolated in the far corner of the state, but a bad news is that's the area of the state that's got the most natural mines and caves. And so if it's any indication of the way it's been spreading westward from Albany, New York, it's probably going to spread pretty quickly through Wisconsin now. And Michigan also was found to have white nose syndrome for the first time as well. So I think it's in 23 states, almost half of the country, and it is an unfortunate thing that there's no remedy to stop this right now. There's no way to help the bats, and it is a very destructive fungal disease, and has killed as many as 100% of the bats in some of the caves out east. So we will watch that, and I know the DNR is being extremely proactive and aggressive in watching that right now, and we'll keep you posted.
Well, and as a homeowner, that has some implications, too. Even prior to the diagnosis, for the past couple of years, our four species of cave bats that hibernate or overwinter in the state are protected. They're threatened species in the state, which means for the homeowner that from June 1st through August 15th, you cannot exclude bats from your attic. So you can't legally kill bats any longer because of that protection. So as far as excluding them, you're going to have to do it outside of that window between June 1st and August 15th. The reason for that is because that's when they have their young, and their young are flightless. The mothers come back and nurse them. So if you exclude them during that time, you're basically killing all of the young. So we want to be really protective of these vulnerable species right now.
But you can, for good information, if you Google Wisconsin Bat Program, they've got great guidelines there. So there are exceptions if you are in a hospital or an assisted care living facility, for example, because there are health issues related to the rabies and bats. There are some exceptions for lethally removing bats if you've tried non-lethal options. And as a homeowner, you can lethally remove up to 5 bats within a 24-hour period, but you need to report that to the DNR. And so go to the Wisconsin Bat Program. There's some very, very good guidelines. There's a reporting form in there for sick or dead bats. And the more information that the citizens of Wisconsin can provide to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, the better the management of this disease and the bat populations.
Phyllis in Milwaukee has a comment. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi, Larry. I was up north. I do live in Milwaukee, but we have land up in Langlade County, about 20 miles outside of Antigo. And last Friday, just sitting out, it was such a nice day, we saw a bird we'd never seen before, and I'm sure they're around there, but we identified it as a woodcock. And it was very close to us in the yard, and everything is pretty wet up there. And it had this long bill and a kind of a yellowish orange breast, and it was the movement of the bird. I know it's a woodcock now, but the movement of the bird was so unusual. It kept kind of bouncing up and down while it was poking its long bill into the ground. And it stayed there. We watched it for about a half an hour, and it finally, it just walked. It didn't fly, and we never did see it fly away. We had to leave, so we didn't see the end of it. But that's my first one, and we've been going up there for years.
Well, Phyllis,
so I just wondered what this movement is.
Well, that's a great observation, and absolutely a woodcock. They are kind of a funny looking
yeah.
bird. You know, they're kind of chunky. They've got a really large eye. They've got the long bill. Their nickname is the timber doodle. Mm-hmm. And right now they're migrating. They're moving from southern parts of the United States, Louisiana, Texas, and so on, moving through into your area is certainly home for them for this time of year and into the fall till the time where they reverse that migration. But as early as the end of March, woodcock were making their way back into Wisconsin and are looking for moist soil habitat now, usually near alders or young forests, aspen, along waterways. And they're probing into the ground. They eat mainly invertebrates, so earthworms and other insects
this
and
bobbing
seeds.
Movement, that's what alerted us right away.
That bobbing?
Yeah.
Bird out there bobbing up and down.
And they're also starting their courtship displays, so they have a very interesting courtship. There's a peent-type call that they make, and males will go into open areas, open grassy areas adjacent to woodlands, and they'll fly up and do a display and then come back down in the exact same spot. So lots of crazy behavior to attract those females, and then again they'll nest on the ground.
It is a ton of fun to watch too. As the sun goes down, you know, go out there with a couple of lawn chairs and a bottle of wine, and it's better than any movie you'll see in a theater.
There you go, Phyllis. Thank you.
That's my entertainment. Thank
yep.
you.
That's right.
Yep. Appreciate the call. And on to John and Marinette. Hi, John.
Hi. My question is, I was wondering if anybody had any idea of how far north the orioles have migrated, if you guys have them down in Madison. I'm calling from Marinette, and we don't have them yet, and I'm getting anxious to see them.
No, we don't get them until like May 3rd.
I haven't seen any, John, and I haven't heard any either, but I'll tell you what, if you go to Wisconsin eBird, Google Wisconsin eBird, you can click on the counties there, and you can also pull up a bunch of different data of people reporting bird sightings, and you can look and see if people have started seeing orioles yet. But I have not seen or heard them here yet. But it won't be much longer for sure.
Usually the first week of May for me.
Yep.
First week of May, they're always here the first week of May in the Madison area.
Yep, that's right.
There you go, John. Thanks. John and Kimberly, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, how's it going, Larry?
Good.
I had an incident that I caught twice. I caught it on my game camera video. Mourning doves and finches feeding at my bird feeder, and then there's a real sharp crack. It almost sounds like a .22, and the birds flush, and immediately thereafter, a Cooper's hawk flies through the scene. One time he missed, and one time he got a mourning dove. Is that sharp crack connected somehow with that Cooper's hawk?
Do you have windows nearby? Is it possible that you have a songbird flushing off that feeder and cracking into
the... No, but it just... The crack happens before anybody flushes.
I don't think it's correlated with the incident.
I don't think they can do it with their wings.
No, they can't make it, and they don't want to because they don't want to startle the bird. So,
okay.
Just
no,
by
I'm,
chance, I think you got there, John.
I can send you a video of it. I thought it was quite interesting.
Oh, please do send it. Put it on my Facebook page.
I can do that.
Oh, I would love that. Thanks. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post it. I know a lot of people would want to see that. I definitely want to see it.
I will do that.
All right. Thank you, John. And we have lots of emails and so forth as well. Mary in Arborvita noted we're visiting their daughter in Edina, Minnesota, pointed out a pair of ducks that would land in her trees in the backyard. Didn't get a good look at them, but wondering, are there species of ducks that dwell in trees? And yes, there are.
Yeah, there are. There are a few. The wood ducks in this area, and also some of the mergansers will nest in trees.
They're all pretty birds, too. Those
very are. Pretty. Very pretty. Not knowing how close she might live to a larger, deeper body of water, there are some differences. Wood ducks are dabbling ducks, so they don't dive. They tip to feed. And the diving ducks, like the mergansers, are going to need deeper water to be able to dive down. So something that's in, it would sort of be dependent on where that property is in the landscape over what species is more likely. But if she gets a good look at the female wood duck has a very descriptive white eye ring and will be easier to tell her apart. She's still going to have a bit of a crest, as will the mergansers, but that white eye ring will help to identify it as a female wood duck. But again, depending on the landscape and what type of water is nearby, that might also give you a clue as to whether it's a merganser or a wood duck.
Mm-hmm.
I would guess when you die in a suburb of Minneapolis, it's probably a wood duck. And wood ducks are smaller. They're smaller, kind of a shorter, squattier bird than a merganser.
Yeah,
merganser's a little bit of a, has a, bit, almost like a loon body.
Right.
You know.
And they're both pretty, but they're both pretty birds, especially the males.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful males. Missy in Dodgeville heard that the golden eagles are migrating through the state about now. Are there any other migrations coming through the state of less common critters? Oh, wow. Where and when might we be able to see them? I saw the snow geese and swan migration last fall and was awestruck.
Well, that is a hard question to answer, when and where. So I'm going to say if you go to the corner of East Oak and Main Street tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, the birds will be queued to come right through there. You know, that's the fun thing about migration is there's general gross queues, and it is all tied to day length, but then there's other refined queues based on amount of precipitation, winds. When they're coming north, they only usually fly in a wind that's coming generally from the south direction, so they don't have to burn more energy. They get a tailwind, you know, insect hatch and all things like that. So, you know, we are on the precipice right now of the spring migration for all these beautiful colored warblers coming up and all that, what we call neotropical migrants. So these birds coming out of the southern United States, Central America, South America. We're maybe, I don't know, a couple weeks, 3 weeks away from the beginning of the peak of that migration. And so just keep your eyes peeled and you will see just this plethora of birds coming up. And it is always a wonderful thing to see in the spring.
Well, and Missy, a couple other places to look is David already mentioned eBird, but that will document sightings and interesting birds, rare birds, as well as common birds, but also places like Horicon National Marsh. The marsh will have a board either on either a website or physically at the education center where they're documenting observations as migration is happening, and eventually they'll start posting, you know, how many geese or ducks are on the refuge at any given time. So those are good resources to kind of check out and see what folks are observing out there.
And we were talking about orioles a minute ago. A caller wanted to share that just south of Madison, his neighbor has had orioles for a couple weeks already, and he's sure they're orioles. So
right. They're on their way.
They're on their way. They're waiting till the 1st of May to get to Madison
right.
And my feeder is
right.
What they're waiting for.
Right.
Oh, man. Teresa in Sugar Camp, hi.
Hi. Thank you all for having the program. I'm really enjoying it.
Thank you.
On Easter Sunday, I was cleaning the mud porch to the farmhouse, and the dog and the cat somehow got a bird in there, and I shooed them out, and it went to the back. The bird went to the back of the porch, and when I went back there, it was a woodcock, and I just talked to it and told it was okay, and finally I was able to pick it up in my hands and take it outside, and I just held it in my palms and let it go, and it waited a minute, and then it flew off. It was fine, but I have never been that close to a woodcock. That's the first time I've seen one like that at the farm, and it was kind of a really spiritual feeling for me to save a woodcock on Easter. So.
Yeah, that is nice. It's lucky that you were there to help it out of that situation.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Thanks, Teresa.
Well, thank you for your program.
Yeah, thank you very much for your story and for your call. Appreciate it very much. We had Carolyn in Madison next. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. Years ago, a farmer friend would put cages of that one-inch fencing, just big circles around any place he found, ground nesting bird, birds in his fields. And so I start doing that under bird feeders at my house, just to keep predators out. Now, the object was to keep predators out. Adults would be able to fly in and out of these, and they weren't that...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just regular fencing you could get it, like, in case anybody wants to give that a try. Running, is that a good solution?
Yeah.
Well, Carolyn, enclosures like that have been used for endangered species like piping plovers along shores where you have predators moving along shorelines and depredating eggs. You know, the key thing here is knowing the species that you're trying to protect and how big that adult gets. So if you use a fence that's got a large, too small of a mesh size, the adult's not going to be able to get in there to attend it.
Fly in, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And having done research on grassland birds and actually a predator study where we put cameras at some of the grassland bird nests, we know who some of the predators are in southwestern Wisconsin. And they include both mammalian but also snakes. But some of the mammals, like 13-line ground squirrels, are fairly small. So I am not sure how effective that technique would be for grassland birds and that it may actually deter the birds. They may abandon the nest if it's too early in its initiation. So, and cages like this are used probably more successfully if it's a turtle nest where the adult does not attend the nest. She lays the eggs, she covers them up, and she leaves, so there's no protection for those eggs. But putting a cage over a known turtle nest can be effective in keeping raccoons or skunks or dogs or things like that away from the nest. But as far as grassland birds where that adult is coming and attending, I'd be concerned about it interfering with the movement of that adult or causing it to abandon. Another strategy to help grassland birds is maybe controlling some of the predator population. So if you do own a piece of property where you might be willing to have somebody come and trap and remove some of the common predators. In our studies, we were finding raccoons were very prolific grassland bird predators. Reducing some of those populations might help. And then the other thing is just maintaining or increasing the amount of grassland habitat in general. That's part of the reason with increased fragmentation, conversion of this grassland habitat to other uses is why these birds have started to or have been declining for a long time.
Yeah. There you go, Carolyn. Thank you so much for calling. Kevin said that he called and said that he was doing catch and release trout fishing near Eau Claire last week, spotted a Canada goose with eggs in the middle of a sandbar.
Well, that's pretty interesting. We were just home for Easter, too, and my parents live on the Sheboygan River, and they have an island right behind the house. And every time we walk in the door, we start a bird list with our young kids, and we have it for the weekend and see what we can find. But it's very typical that there is a goose nest on the island.
Yeah.
So we, you know, depends on, not every year it's successful, but this year we had all that rain just recently, so she abandoned, but the island was pretty well gone except for a small little area, and there were 5 white eggs on that little bit of grass yet, and she had abandoned. She came, the pair came the next day and were swimming around the island, but hopefully she will re-nest, but it basically got flooded out. But islands are really usually a good strategy for nest placement because predators, again, like raccoons and things like that, don't want to be swimming. So it's more of an aerial predator concern than it would be from mammalian. So it's a good strategy, but not when we get a lot of rain or weather events.
And just to note that the loons are back in Madison, on the Madison Lakes.
Yep.
And I know one day just went out and did a count with binoculars on Mendota and counted 65.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
On Mendota. So no,
I saw one Mendota flying overhead a couple weeks ago over U-Bay Fields and noted they're back, and saw one floating on the lake the other day. So, yeah, it's nice that they're back.
Well, it's nice to have you guys with us. You'll come back again soon. We'll do it again, I hope.
Sounds
absolutely
good.
Jamie Knack, Wildlife Outreach Specialist, and David Drake, Wildlife Specialist with Extension and both with the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guests. Boy, it's always so much fun when they come by, and they'll be back. Tomorrow at 11, we'll visit with folks from the Wisconsin Consumer Protection, Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Stay with us.